Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Fantasy Focus Football. They tape every morning, Monday through Friday, live on Twitter. Be sure to check it out if you're interested in the very best analysis in the game, or if you're just ashamed of how your team is performing and want to live vicariously through others. Follow Fantasy Focus Football as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Also, ESPN Plus subscribers, join an ESPN Plus Fantasy Football League now for a chance to win $250,000. Sweepstakes is U.S. only, 18 or older. No purchase necessary. Visit ESPN.com/ESPN Plus football rules for full details and official rules. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to catch you up on something you might not know about our man Lamont from Italia, Italy. But first, all right, so I got a couple things about like how I look at the world and how I see life and just how we should do things. Number one, I'm generally of the belief that when people die, at least for the first 48 hours or so, you just say nice stuff about them, right? Like being right is not always that important. And no matter who it is, somebody dies, somebody's hurting, so forth and so on. And so you just kind of like ride that out. And that's generally my outlook on things. That I want to start with as I say this. There was a second thing I was going to say that I completely forgotten that might come around back to my mind at some point, but we'll get to it whenever it is. But Bobby Bowden died this weekend at the age of 91. Now, for people who are, I don't want to say younger than me, but I would say like considerably younger than me, like particularly if you're about 10, maybe 15 years younger than me, you know, like if you were born in that space, I think it's kind of instructive to hear what people say about Bobby Bowden who are like telling the truth. And what I mean by the truth is I keep seeing all these folks and they got these stories. They all pop up and they talk about what a great human being he was and the impact he had on lives and making everybody feel like a Hall of Famer and stuff like that. And that stuff is largely true. Like, I'm not discounting the truth in such a statement. This is, however, what I'm saying about Bobby is that ain't why we talking about him. We talk about Bobby Bowden because, damn it, he was fun. Like, when I was a kid, football coaches, especially in college, were fun, right? They talk shit to one another, for example. You don't really have that happen so much in this day and age. But there was a particular charm to the football coach. Not every single one of them, obviously. But the charm was in large part because the game wasn't quite so corporate. You know, like all these guys wanted to come up and they wanted to be football coaches and so forth and so on. But the money game wasn't quite the same and everything else. But what we wound up with were personalities. And so if you stop and think now about college football, how many of the prominent coaches would you describe as personalities? Like, the more I think about it, honestly, the closest that we get to it is like Dabo Swinney. And Dabo's not really a personality. He just country. Right. Like, he got that accent and that for a lot of people doubles as a proxy for a personality. And that's not the same thing. I'm not saying the man doesn't have one, but the defining characteristic of Dabo Swinney is not like the personality that he was offering. But when you go back and you think about the names of who the big time coaches were 1950s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s and like the 90s is when it kind of goes in a different direction. The personalities of the coaches are a big part of why it is that we were there. So you had like a contrast with Oklahoma, Nebraska, for example, with Barry Switzer, who had all the personality versus a guy like Tom Osborne, who basically had none. Man, everybody kicking like Tom Osborne now, more or less. Like Nick Saban. Nick Saban's not giving you personality. You're not getting much fun out of hearing Nick Saban talk. Les Miles. Now, that guy gave you personality, right? Now, granted, we don't talk about him no more for good reason. But that was a guy that I would say, you know, gave you this personality that we talked about coming from coaches. But you go look around up and down, man, that's not really the case anymore. Yeah, you threw a finger up. Like, did I miss somebody?
Lane Kiffin.
Yeah, but he's just an asshole. Like, there's a difference. You know what I'm saying? Like he kind of has a personality. It's just that we don't like him. But like Bobby Bowden, when you think about stuff like this, like before it all got so corporate and everything became so regimented, you guys have probably heard the stories of the 99 Sugar Bowl and Sebastian Janikowski. And if you are not aware of Sebastian Janikowski, he was this big old like 6'4", 6'5", 280-pound kicker from Poland, right? Like who was just, I mean, Florida State for all these years had kicking problems, right? All these games and national championships they might have lost out on because of kicking. And so they got one. It was such a big deal for Florida State to get a kicker that in 1993, Florida State ultimately won the national championship. They had a quarterback that won the Heisman Trophy that year. Who was on the cover of the Sports Illustrated College Football Preview issue? A true freshman kicker that Florida State had just recruited because finally they had a kicker that wasn't going to blow the game against Miami. Like, that's what a big deal it was about Florida State with the kicker. So down the line, they get Janikowski. Janikowski, the best kicker in America, all this. And had this big old personality. So Janikowski misses curfew the week of the Sugar Bowl. Now, understand this is also 1999, the year that Peter Ward had gotten suspended for a stretch because he got caught running the game at Dillard's. You know the game. You bring a whole bunch of stuff up there, and little mama just ring up a pair of socks, and you get all the stuff, but you only pay for the socks, and they got caught, right? Bobby Bowden sat up at the press conference about Peter Ward and said, and I will just never forget this. This is not an exact quote, but it's a close enough paraphrase. Bobby Bowden said, if a player tells me that he got a really good discount, I want to see if I can get it myself. Janikowski missed curfew. He had two different things that he said about that. They asked if Janikowski's going to miss the game because he missed curfew. One of the things he said, he'll miss the game if either he has a heart attack or I do. And the other one about why he missed curfew, Bowden said he actually didn't miss curfew. He was on Warsaw time. Because you could say stuff like that then, right? Bobby Bowden is like, ain't no way in hell I'm about to not play this dude in the game. What are you kidding me? And he didn't even have to pretend as though this was something that he actually had to acknowledge. Because there was a measure of personality that we appreciated and understood the college football coaches had. And we did not ask them to present the facades that we ask people to present now when they coach college football. That's the reason why we remember Bobby Bowden. We don't remember Bobby Bowden just because of all those wins. And please understand, it was a bunch of wins. I don't care about like the total where you get to talking about like 377, I think is what it was. They finished in the top five 14 years in a row. 14 years in a row. And I counted it. They had five different seasons in that stretch where they only lost one regular season game, and that regular season loss was to Miami, right? And this is when Miami was just like the dominant thing. The way we hype up Alabama LSU has nothing on what Miami Florida State was, because Miami and Florida State, they were both not just kind of good, like really good every single year. You go up and down the line and you see it. Like there's some breaks, like 93 Miami wasn't that good, and you know, the probation stuff or whatever. But this stretch, it was a whole different animal. I don't know if there'll ever be anything quite like what Miami, Florida State was for the stretch of time that was there. And it was all personality because Bobby, just like Miami, the players had personality. Now, before I lose track of this, because I remember this, this is a fun fact that a lot of people do not know. Florida State had never finished in the final AP poll before Bobby Bowden was coach. Forget about the top five. Forget about a national championship. I'm talking about the AP top 20 at the end of the year before they expanded it to 25. The AP top 20, they had never finished in there before Bobby Bowden got there. Never finished at that stretch. And you know why? It all picked up with Bobby. Bobby looked around and was like, you know, if we get some of these black fellas in here, I got a feeling we could be a little bit better at football. And that's big. That's big. Because I think that the way that we think about integration in football, especially if you're young, you don't have a way, like a real context for this. You feel like the early 1970s come around and we decide, okay, Southern teams are going to recruit black players, and then they recruit black players. But it didn't look like the SEC looks like right now. Remember, we talked about that the other day, where he's like, start naming the great white defensive players in the SEC in the last 15, 20 years. You basically get David Pollack, and you don't get much past that, right? It was a slow process, especially for the Southern schools, when it came to integrating their football teams. Of course, it took forever for all of them to actually integrate, like, the quarterback position. But there were still positions that you knew they were going to have a white dude out there. It's probably going to be a white dude at middle linebacker, going to be a white dude at center, or probably all along the offensive line. But work was continuously done just to make sure that there was going to be a white dude here, there, whatever. But they were not trying to go to all black teams. That wasn't what it was about to be. And so Bobby did not immediately go to all black teams. But you go back and think about those Florida State teams of the 80s and 90s. Other than a quarterback, maybe an offensive lineman, name the white dudes. You can't. Just wasn't the game. That wasn't what they were playing. Both Miami and Florida State accelerated the integration of college football in the 1980s because they figured out that there was a market failure. One, people don't realize how good the players are in Florida. And B, both of those schools were not standing on top of this great long lineage or tradition and all these people that they wound up having to answer to. They went out there to win. And so they went and got the best players. And so for Bowden, it wasn't just about getting the best players. It was a legitimate paradigm shift in what you prioritized in a football player. Bowden's one of the first coaches to take corners and make them safeties, right? Take safeties and make them linebackers. Take linebackers and make them defensive ends. Take defensive ends and make them defensive tackles. Speed was the priority, right? We got a state that produces the fastest players in football. We are going to be the fastest team everywhere. Like when it started shutting down for Florida State at the end of the aughts in this millennium and Mickey Andrews' defense was just getting destroyed, my man Adam Gold at Raleigh made a great point. He was like, yeah, because for all these years, all Mickey had to do was rush four and drop seven because all your players were so fast and it felt like you had 12 dudes out there. Like it didn't require a significant amount of strategy. But it was a revolutionary concept and idea that they were basically rocking with. We're going to play the best players that we can find. And that's what they did. And they did it with this big old country boy out there in front who talked with that deep accent and always sounded like he was your best friend at every turn, right? That's what they were doing. Like you think about this also with Florida State football. This was not a quarterback-centered program. When you start thinking about like the Florida State quarterbacks, Charlie Ward won a Heisman, yes. And Chris Winkie, at age 48, or however old he was at the end, he wound up winning a Heisman. But think about who the quarterbacks were on those teams that were doing all that winning. The Casey Weldons, the Thad Busbys. Like Danny Cannell, who was actually of those guys. I mean, he played in the NFL for a while. Like he was better than most of the guys that they had. But you go up and down and start naming the guys who played quarterback at Florida State. This wasn't about that. This was about the dudes. This was about the players. And the unifying force with all of that was Bobby Bowden. The only guy that I can think of who became endearing for not winning the big one. Because I think that stretch there, 7 out of 9 years that they lost to Miami. 7 out of 9 years that they lost to Miami. And I think it's 89, they finally messed around and beat Miami, and Miami still went on to win a national championship anyway. Right? And it was all these games with these kicks, wide right one, wide right two. And you just had these clips of Bobby Bowden after the game, just standing out there with his hands on his hips. And you could tell the loss hurt him, but it never broke him down, right? There was always just like some level of charm that always came through, almost some bright side level that was always there. Like he became, with all those wins and everything else, he just couldn't get over the hump with Miami. And now people wanted him to get over the hump with Miami because somehow Miami and Florida State were very, very similar programs. In many ways, Florida State was just biting Miami style. If you watch the U documentary Billy Corbin did, you'll see what a lot of that was. They were trying so hard to be that, but America wanted Miami to lose so bad. And Florida State was your best hope, and they just couldn't quite get there. And so we got this guy in the end that we all love so much. And I would say that like outside of Gainesville and like people who rooted for the University of Florida and maybe Miami, Bobby Bowden's Q rating as a college football coach is probably higher than anybody else's was that I can think of, right? But this is where we get to where I started this discussion when I talked about we normally say nice things about people when they die and all this. The last memorable thing that Bobby Bowden did, the man had COVID in his 90s, okay? He has COVID, and he puts out a statement to let us know that he's going to be okay, so forth and so on. but he wanted to recover from COVID so that he could make sure that he was able to go vote for Donald Trump. That's what he said. Now, look, I understand that there's people out here listening to this that voted for Donald Trump. I don't have time to argue with you about that right now. I'm not arguing with you about the politics of the matter. What I am saying is, a man who knew he did not have much time left, even if it wasn't just from COVID, you know, he's 90 years old. He wanted us to know that. Like, he wanted to put his name on that, which I think is a safe thing for me to say, that that's how he wanted to be remembered. Like, that's something that he wanted, you know, on, not on the actual tombstone, but like in the obit, on the virtual tombstone. That's what he wanted. He wanted us to remember that he supported Donald Trump. And I have to tell you, man, I'm not alone in this. I talked to somebody else about this yesterday. That was heartbreaking, man. Like, I didn't realize how much, I don't know if credit's the right word. I don't know the best way to articulate it, but there's something about a guy like Bowden. And when I say like him, I mean really like this gregarious white Southerner who you think in theory, like if I took somebody with Bobby Bowden's voice and didn't tell you anything about him and gave him his look and everything else, I got a feeling I know the assumptions you would make about what he believed, what his views were, all those things, right? Those of us who are like black and from the South and grew up around white people can't necessarily afford to make that assumption about everybody. Because a lot of us did come up in times where a lot of these people that you would make these assumptions about and you would think these things about have come through for us, have been there for us. Now, the relationship may have started in something that was like convenient and mutually beneficial, like being your football coach or something like that. You know what I mean? But we got a lot of cats like that who have been people who were important to us, but you never quite know what they think. And you don't really ask about it because it doesn't really benefit you in any way to do such a thing. You know, you just don't. And you can have these moments where something like this happens and you don't realize how much you actually may have had invested in a man like that, or invested in a man like Bobby Bowden, until you hear that. And I'm just going to be honest with you. Then, you know, well, this is the other thing I was going to say, where I said there was two things. I don't, and you've heard me talk about this, making these things that happen to other people about ourselves when they're not about us, right? And so forgive me if that's what I'm doing. I don't believe that is. I think there's a distinction, but I could be rationalizing that to myself. Like, I'm self-aware enough to give that I may not be doing this the right way. But Bobby Bowden wanted us to remember that he went out there to vote for Donald Trump. He wanted us to remember that he wanted to live to vote for Donald Trump. And damn it, Bobby, I don't want to remember that, if I'm going to be perfectly honest. That is not what I want to think about when it's Bobby Bowden. It just isn't. And like I talk about not making those assumptions, for example, Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy Johnson is from Port Arthur, Texas, right? Now you think about Port Arthur, Texas, home of UGK, Pimp C and Bun B. Yes, that is true. As anybody that's from the part of Texas that I'm from, and they'll tell you, once you get east of Houston, ooh boy, the racism gets powerful. Powerful, I tell you, powerful. You take I-10 out of Houston, and that racism gets strong. And them little towns that's neighboring around Port Arthur are absurdly racist. I encourage you to check out Jimmy Johnson's book or go read anything about Jimmy Johnson. Because Jimmy Johnson is one of those guys that you might have made that same assumption about, right? Where I'm talking about, you see the presentation, you see the way they sound and everything else. And Jimmy ain't that guy at all. At all. Not even close. And you kind of, in some ways, look at a dude like Bobby and like, you think that what Jimmy Johnson was is kind of what you want that dude to be. Like, why it's wild when you see Barry Switzer and everything he was back in the day. And Barry Switzer, who grew up around black people in Arkansas, right? Whose dad, I think his dad got shot riding in the car, or got killed riding in the car with his black girlfriend, like all of this. Like, Barry Switzer's autobiography is all about his ability to recruit black players, was about his relationships with black people and growing up with them and being on, you know, what was in the colored side of town and all of that stuff. And then you hear some of the stuff that Switzer says now, and it's just, dag, dog, we didn't think that was you. You know, And with Bobby, I don't want to define a man by one thing because I'm sure that there's a lot more to it. But he told us that that was the thing that he wanted us to remember about him. And it's hard. And I have not been able to get past that as I think about everything with Bobby Bowden. And as I see people do these retrospectives on him and everybody, you know, he made everybody feel like a Hall of Famer, you know, and those sorts of things until the end. Because it felt like you don't think we belong in nobody's Hall of Fame. If that's what you wanted to put on your name, it's hard for me to think that you looked at me like a Hall of Famer after that. That's just charm. That's just game. In the end, you want something to be there that's fundamental. And obviously, I wish that man the best. Obviously, I want that man to rest in peace. All of those things. I have no reason to think otherwise. And you don't want one thing that somebody does to define a person. I just don't know what you do when that person tells you that they want that thing to define them. All right, Gabe. Last week, we talked about gold medal Lamont from Italy. Gold medalist in the 100 meters with a 980. His name Lamont, and he from Italy. I just want to point out to some of you guys, right? I said this thing. I thought we did a very funny thing about Lamont and how America no longer has the best Lamonts. And of course, Gabe, you know what happened. Assholes from near and far. Well, Lamont's actually from Texas, so we do still have the top Lamont. Was he running for us? He out here putting on for Italy, right? It don't matter if he was born here. We couldn't keep, we need to shut down the border, apparently, because we letting good Lamonts get out of here.
Oh, he from El Paso.
First of all, I know that. Number two, he gone from El Paso now. That don't matter. We lost a good, you know how hard it is to find a good Lamont? Think about all the Lamonts you know. How many of them are good? It's so hard to find a good Lamont. We lost a good Lamont. They already trying to take Lamont down, though. They treating him like Lamont. Apparently, he had a trainer that got caught up in some kind of steroid situation. And so they tried to bring that to Lamont. And Lamont and his people made it known that they stopped working with that man in March. As soon as they found out there was a probe, that they block got hot, they got away from him. And I was like, damn, they already trying to take Lamont down. Ain't that something? And I was thinking that it may wind up with some legs to it. But no, Lamont going to keep his gold medal. Olympics done passed. I don't think there's going to be anything to it. He going to go home. I don't know if they're going to give him some major parade in Italy. Like, I feel like they should. I feel like if you win the 100 meters, you should get a parade no matter where you're from. Because that is the most fundamental event at the Olympics. The one thing that anybody can participate in, everybody's been in a race. That's the one. The 100 meters. They should have a parade for Lamont. But let me tell you why I realized they wasn't going to be taking Lamont down. My good buddy Corey Erdman hit me up with this. Didn't realize this. You know what Lamont is, Gabe? He 5'0". Lamont's a cop. Yeah, Lamont 5'0". Look this up. Apparently a significant portion of the Italian athletes in their spare time double as police officers. And Lamont is a police officer. And y'all can have him. Y'all can have that Lamont. I couldn't believe it gave you the cops. I just saw that. I just could not believe that he was the cops. Like that. That was that. I thought there were so many things that he possibly could be. Why would I ever have thought that he was the cops? Lamont's the cops. Gabe, you ever had one of your friends turn out to be the cops?
Not one of my friends, exactly.
Man. Nothing quite like when you find out your partner or you come across somebody that and they turn out to be the cops. High school reunion was the first time that happened. Went back to high school reunion. It was cool. I didn't really know him that well or whatever. But I saw him there. Turned out he was the cops. No wonder he was over there standing by himself. He the cops. I ever tell you about the time my brother brought the cops to the crib?
You have before, but please tell it again.
All right. So it was Christmas 2012. One of my homeboys had come down with me to spend Christmas with the family because he couldn't make it back to the crib. So he was there. And my brother had invited his homeboy from growing up who lived down the street. And he came there. And before he came in, me and my partner, you know, Christmas holidays, you know, life. We went and took a walk. You know what I'm saying? So we go. We take a walk. We come back. We sitting down. you know, feeling like we took a walk. And then next thing I know, one of my parents is like, I'm going to change the name to protect the cops. And he's like, oh, John, so what are you doing these days? He's like, oh, man, still police. Man, me and my homeboy's head popped up like, what? Y'all got the cops at the dinner table? And so next thing you know, he started telling this story about when he first became the cops. And he said that he was riding around on what they call it, his beat. And he had seen somebody that he knew from the neighborhood. And so he pulled up behind him and he put the lights on. But this is like the old days. He rode around like, what was my man named? Hunter. Well, you got to take the light out the car and put it on top of the car. You know what I'm saying? And so he do that. He put the light on top of the car. And so he goes and pulls the dude over. And he's like, put your hands on the wheel. And he got the spotlight on him. You know, put your hands on the dash. You know, all the hands on the wheel. Put your hands out the window. Get out the car. You know? And this ain't in a great neighborhood where this is all going. So he doing all this stuff. My man do everything he say. Get out the car. So he gets out the car. Put your hands up. So he puts his hands up. Now lay on the ground. So he lays on the ground. All for a hearty har. All for a hearty har. All so he can roll up after the fact and be like, ha, ha, ha. I was just playing with you. And he's telling this story at the table. And he just thinks this is so funny. And I'm sitting over here like, when did we start hanging out with the cops? I just feel like there's got to be a certain separation. You know what I'm saying? Like, they authority, we not. We got to have some, like, space in between us. But you're not about to come in here joking with us about harassing people while you was the cops. And you've been the cops by then by, like, 30 years. Get your pension and go. Why are you even still doing this? What for? What for? And that's Lamont. You know, dog, Lamont. Damn, Lamont. I mean, I guess we all got to find a way to make a living. We got to find a way to get by. I do wonder this, though. I do wonder what the process is for a Lamont to become a police officer in Italy. Like, I feel like it ain't that many Lamonts out here serving as the law and order. I could be wrong, but I just don't feel like it's like that. Like, that's just a prevalent situation that's going on there. Yeah, man, bump Lamont. Lamont, the cops. The cops. You're probably telling them jokes in Italian accents. Man, please. Anyway, yeah, I just wanted to give y'all the update on Lamont. It was very, very disappointing to find out that Officer Lamont, that's what he is. Sergeant Lamont, that's what he is. Should he even, like, if you police, I feel like you shouldn't even be allowed to compete, man. How can we trust that these results are safe? You got too much power. That's all I'm saying. You got too much power. You got too much sway. Wait, also, by the way, finding out that how many of these Olympic athletes are in Italy are police. Don't you try to run from them. They will catch you. Like, let me tell you what I mean. I think we need our police force to be a lot of things. The last thing we needed to be is more athletic. Like, you imagine that? Like you know, you're out here doing what you're doing. All of a sudden, next thing you know, the cops start running after you. You're like, cool, I got a head start. Next thing you know, the cops start sucking you up. Start closing the gap. I thought you was police. That's my favorite thing about watching cop shows, like Law and Order and stuff like that. They were like, yo, man, them dudes be running really fast in them wingtips in their 30s and 40s. They be taking corners, everything else. Like, you're just not going to make me believe in real life that the cops catch as many people from behind as they have you believe that they do on television. Except in Italy. In Italy, the cops are going to get you. Trust.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from business.
Hi, this is Caroline Anders with the Washington Post. So the gist of this story is bacon prices are about to see a little rise in California, along with other cuts of pork, eggs, and veal. And that's because in 2018, Californians passed a ballot initiative that is about to go into effect on the first of the year that requires larger cages for these animals. So if you are a farmer raising these animals in California and trying to sell them in California, you're going to need to update your cages to make sure they comply with the law. But also, if you're a farmer outside of California in maybe Iowa and you want to sell your product to Californians, your cages would also have to comply with that California law. So animal rights activists who really pushed for this say this is great, you know, we're treating animals more humanely. And then some people in the meat industry say this law is actually a little misguided and doesn't fully grasp the kind of care animals require. Estimates predict that the average Californian will spend about $50 more on these foods over the course of a year. But an important part to note of this story is that it's also estimated that only about 4% of hog farms in the U.S. currently comply with the new standards set by the law. So there could be pork shortages in California and a significant increase in price as farms work with these new regulations.
I just wanted to let y'all know this just because I know how y'all feel about y'all's bacon. Gabe, I don't know if you remember the era of Twitter where everybody just spent all their time talking about how much they love bacon. Like, that was the way that you impress your homies and everything else. You're just telling them that you loved you some bacon. That was the whole game that was going down. Now these bacon prices on everything are going up. I thought that this was going to wind up being a little bit more pandemic related in terms of why the prices on this stuff are going up. But no, it's the cages. Like, let me tell you something Americans going to find out. Like, especially there's a lot of people who want the world to be a better place. And obviously, I'm not judging you for wanting the world to be a better place. But I'm just talking about, like, people who want the world to be a better place. It's going to cost money to make that world a better place. And we're going to see how much a lot of people are willing to pay in order for this world to actually be a better place. Now, whether it should or should not be that way, okay, we're going to find out. But the nature of humanity and the nature of expectations and everything else, we are going to find out that a lot of y'all cannot afford to be the good people that y'all want to be. I'm not judging you for it. I'm not judging anybody really on it. I'm just telling you, once you find out what some of this stuff costs, a whole lot of y'all are going to be like, well, they was just going to kill them pigs anyway.
They can keep the costs low because the animals are in these, like, appalling conditions, right?
Right.
If they're going to improve the conditions of the animals, improve the quality of life,
yep,
improve the quality of the product, then they're going to pass off the cost of that to the consumers.
Yep. It's like, do you love these pigs enough to give up bacon? We're going to find out.
All right. This next story also comes from business.
This is Eduardo Castillo, journalist with the Associated Press in Mexico City. The Mexican government announced these days something unprecedented. It filed a lawsuit against U.S. gun manufacturers and distributors in a U.S. federal court. Mexican authorities argue that their negligent and illegal commercial practices have unleashed a bloodshed in Mexico, a country affected for more than a decade by the violence attributed to drug cartels. The unusual lawsuit was filed in a federal court in Boston, and among those being sued are some of the biggest names in guns, including Smith & Wesson Brands, Beretta USA Corp., and Colt's Manufacturing Company. The Mexican government says that the companies know that their practices contribute to the trafficking of guns to Mexico and facilitate it. As part of the litigation, Mexico says that it wants a compensation, and some officials mention a number, $10 billion. The government estimates that 70% of the weapons trafficked to Mexico come from the U.S., and that in 2019 alone, at least 17,000 homicides were linked to trafficked weapons. The manufacturers have not said anything yet, but the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the U.S. Firearm Industry's Trade Association, rejected in a statement Mexico's allegations, and it said that it is the Mexican government that is responsible for the rampant crime in the country, not the U.S. firearm industry. Steve Shadowin, the lead attorney representing Mexico in the U.S. court, says that there's an immunity statute for the manufacturers, but he argues that it only applies inside the U.S. territory, not in a foreign country. What's going to happen? It's not clear yet, but some experts think that Mexico's effort is a long shot. Now we have to wait and see what the federal court in Boston says in coming days.
So basically what you're telling me, the Mexican government wishes to treat American gun makers like the American government wishes to treat Mexican drug dealers. Like this is wild, interesting, and ironic to me, just what the back and forth is. Because the American government would have you believe that if it were not for all these Mexican cartels and everybody else, we wouldn't have no drug problem in the United States. And the Mexicans always say, and this is all these countries, Mexico, Colombia, anybody else, I guess Afghanistan would count too, because they got the heroin game, you know, but any place that's out here where they pumping out that dope. They look at America and say that your problem is that you have the demand for these drugs. Flip this up, and the Mexicans are like, yo, we got all these problems because we got all these guns, and you're the ones sending us these guns. And they're like, no, your problem is that you guys want to kill each other. Like, it's basically the same thing. It's basically the same fight. I do think, though, that this is a fair and interesting question, which is, we're not talking about drug dealers. We're talking about, for lack of a better term, legitimate businessmen. The gun industry is a legitimate business by the standards of legitimacy that we have currently, right? What they do is sell guns. They don't think too much after the fact about who gets the guns or what gets done with the guns. What they do is sell guns. So the way they see it, we just doing what it is to sell guns. Now, do they do things that they know ultimately lead to the guns getting into Mexico, to wreaking all that havoc that goes on? Maybe. But you know what? They're looking at it like, I mean, what you think a gun do? Like, they got all this public stuff that they talk about with gun safety and everything else, but in the end, they know what guns do. The great philosopher Ronald Van Zant, handguns are made for killing. They ain't good for nothing else. It's the whole point of it. It is a pocket-sized killing machine. That's what they're there for. No, I don't have my gun to kill people. I have my gun to protect my house by killing or threatening to kill somebody, right? Like, that's the whole point of having them. And so to hit a gun manufacturer, it'd be like, hey, man, your guns are killing people. They're like, yeah. I mean, no, people are killing people. Duh.
All right, this last story comes from Transit.
I'm Sam Sweeney with ABC News, and it's the video seen all around the world. A 22-year-old Ohio man duct taped to the seat of a Frontier Airlines flight after allegedly groping two flight attendants and then fighting a third one. In the video, you can hear passengers cheering as the man curses and then tells other passengers his parents have more than $2 million before talking about his grandfather. Well, for the remainder of the flight, 22-year-old Max Berry was taped to his seat. And then Frontier Airlines initially suspended the flight crew, saying they didn't follow proper procedure. Well, within hours of the nation's largest flight attendant union saying Spirit did a knee-jerk reaction by suspending the crew, Frontier released another statement saying that they now support their crew but are keeping them off the job on paid leave while they investigate. Meantime, Max Berry faces multiple charges, and this comes as the airlines see a surge in unruly passenger behavior. The FAA now saying that more than 3,700 reports of unruly behavior have been filed since January 1st. The head of the FAA now asking bars and restaurants and airports across the country to stop serving to-go alcohol, and even asking airport police to start arresting more unruly passengers instead of questioning and releasing them.
Hey, man, I don't really know what it is that these flight attendants are supposed to do if they can't do that. You know, because one thing that's going on, and you're seeing this, like the pushback for like the flight attendant union and stuff like that. They're like, yo, what are we supposed to do? Because one thing about being a flight attendant is ain't nobody getting to that job to fight. I think I've talked about this before. Airplanes, there is nothing of more value where nobody got a gun than an airplane. And that's even as far as we know, at least. Like I said, there's got to be somebody on there that know kung fu. Like, there's got to be a last line of defense or whatever it is. But if somebody start acting a donkey on a plane, there really aren't a lot of strategies of what you can do because you can't just kick them out. That's the other thing about the airplane. Like, if somebody's wilding out in the Uber or somebody wilding out on the Greyhound, we can toss you overboard. You know, if somebody wilding out on the cruise ship big enough that we may not be able to toss you over the side, but we can at least lock you in a room. There's nowhere to put you if you wilding out on an airplane. Nowhere at all. And that dude that was wilding out on that Frontier flight, he wasn't going far enough to where, like, everybody could participate in whooping his ass. You know, so they did wind up, he got into the tussle. Actually, he was throwing blows, wasn't he? Anywhere else, you just get stomped out. But the people who want to be flight attendants, they're not from the out-stomping demographic. You feel me? Like, that's just not what they got in the job for. They like free vacations. In many cases, they don't feel comfortable being attached to one place because of some deep-seated issues. They don't tend to stick with stuff. You know? It's a great job if you want to be like an actor or an actress or something like that, because you work like 3 days a week and your days are free. Otherwise, you can make a whole, you know, there's a lot of pluses to it. Nobody's in there because they want to fight people, right? They just want to walk up and down that aisle, give you your drinks, hope that you don't like hit on them too much. That's all they really trying to do. For them to be like, nah, we just going to tape you to the chair. You wildin', bro. You wildin'. And we saw it. But I'm just trying, like, what can they do? They have so little recourse on what they can do to stop you if you start acting up on the plane. That's it. And so, to me, if the situation is that they can't let the flight attendants handle it themselves, that means they're going to have to outsource that to the people. And they just kind of got to figure out how to outsource that to the people. For example, when I was a teenager, you know, we get a little mouthy when we're teenagers, right? I don't remember exactly what I said, but I got a little mouthy with my mother. My brother, who is at that time 13 years older and at least 100 pounds heavier, took umbrage, grabbed me by the shirt, put me up on the wall, right? Lesson learned. Lesson learned. You know what my mama did? Watched. She just watched. In later years, in an argument, I unloaded how I felt about her just watching. She just watched. She didn't think it would be right for her to do herself, but she sure felt like somebody should have done it. She was probably correct. But you get my point, right? If mama can't whoop his ass, then we got
to
do it.
People need to act right. We can't get to a situation where we start getting cops on the airplanes.
No, we can't. We don't need the cops. Because one thing we have learned in this pandemic is, once you send the word out that it's okay for the customers to fight the unruly passenger, there's a long line of customers who wake up every day, hoping that you tell them it's okay to kick somebody's ass. Every day. On a Frontier flight? Frontier? This ain't no Learjet, baby. There's somebody who got on that plane going to Hawaii or somewhere like that and still was just like, I'm ready right now. Somebody always ready. Always ready. So look, if the flight attendants can't do it, we got you. At least in the back of the plane. I really don't know what y'all be doing back there. Granted, I've only been on one flight since the pandemic started, but it was pretty peaceful up there in the front.
Maybe that's the voicemail segment for next week.
Oh, yeah, just because it had to, I told you, man, I saw somebody almost get it at the Atlanta airport. This white man called somebody the N-word at a gate, and I'm like, you are the bravest white man in the world. Like, if I start going down up and down the list of places not to call somebody the N-word, Hartsfield is at the top of the list.
Did he get stomped out?
Nah, because it's the airport. Like, that's the thing. Have you ever seen a fight at the airport? Yeah, like, people don't fight at the airport. It's just not that kind of place. He had to avoid, what saved him from a stomp out was, it was some dudes, I guess they were shipping out because they was all in like desert fatigues. And that's what saved a white man from the stomp out at that point. But one dude, whoo boy, wanted to give it to him bad, bad. Our greatest voicemails are fueled by Gatorade. Whatever path you take to greatness, Gatorade is there to fuel it. Greatness starts with G.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. Voicemail time. I thought it was a good week for a quit on the job segment topic, because when is it not a good time?
Yeah, it's not. And I know some of you thinking, man, you guys are recycling through old topics. We only use 3 voicemails. You think only 3 people got good stories on this stuff? We try to help y'all get the best.
That's right. And our first one comes from Ed in Biloxi.
The story I got for you, man, in terms of watching somebody quit is crazy. I was 19, working in Biloxi, Mississippi, President Casino, and we had a roach problem, which, you know, down there on the ocean, that's common. You know, some people call them water bugs, but we know what a roach is. So we had let the supervisors know about the problem. You know, I was a dishwasher, and we would see them all the time in the dish room. So, of course, you know, we tell our supervisor, they reach out to Ecolab. Ecolab comes, bombs for roaches. Nobody tells us when they're coming, though. So 2 days later, we come into work right as Ecolab is leaving the building, and they told us just about how bad the infestation was. We get upstairs, second floor of the casino. You know, we walking into the dish room, ready for our second shift. You know how that is, walking in, freestyling, acting stupid. And all we see is dead roach bodies. I turn around, I look at my boy P and my boy Greg. They look at me. P throws up the deuces, walks off before the shift starts. Me and Greg try to tough through it. Our supervisor comes with a broom and tells us, hey, I need y'all to sweep up the bodies. I'll just let you know right now, that was my last day on the job. That was Greg's last day on the job. I ain't seen that one of them since, man. It was crazy.
I've been thinking that for the longest. They may call them water bugs, but we know what a roach is. Like, when people would try to explain to me that there was some differentiation between roaches and water bugs, and look, he's right. Like, by the water, or like if you got a pool in your backyard, you can have roaches, not because you nasty, but they still roaches. Like that don't change nothing. Those are still roaches. How do you not clean up the corpses before people come? Like, that's got to be job one. Like, hey, right away, let's get them things out of here. Whatever. Like, that's got to be part of the service, right?
Can't you imagine that, like, bombing roaches and then immediately going into work, he'd be breathing in some, like, really bad stuff?
One would think. Yeah, that actually reminds me of this time my brother quit a job. And so I just had to call him and tell him to call in and give his story.
All right, whatever, Bo. I had this job at the Atlanta Linen Service for a top loader. Paid $5.50 an hour. It was a big step up because I had been making the minimum wage the previous summer. Right? The job was to take these laundry bags off top of the truck and throw them in the right bin. Right? First day on the job. It's getting hard. It's getting tired. Now I'm feeling, well, I'm going to be yoked at the end of the summer, but I'm really getting tired. It's 100 degrees in Atlanta. I'm up on top of a truck, so it's even hotter up there, but I'm making it happen. I'm making it happen. Then it starts raining. Right. So now all of a sudden the bags are twice as heavy and I'm having to toss them all the way off the back of the truck. This one truck comes in and one, it starts raining. So the everything's even heavier and the bags are all stained and nasty. I look down at my gloves. I got like these yellowish brownish stains and it stinks. And I'm asked the dude downstairs down that drove the truck in. I'm like, dude, where'd this truck come from? Where's this laundry from? He's like, one word, hospital. So now I'm completely grossed out. And I noticed that I had been crunching around on top of the truck, too. And I didn't know what it was because I was so tired. I could barely see straight. I look down, and it looks like it's like rice or macaroni spilled all over the truck. Then I feel something like on my face, and I pull it off. I look at it. It's a maggot. And then I realize it's maggots all over the truck. It's maggots all over on me, including like on my body, on my person, because I didn't have no shirt on. It was the nastiest thing, the grossest thing I have ever encountered in my entire life. That was the one day that I worked that job. When I left, they were like, hey, see you tomorrow. I just threw up deuces. I didn't even come back and get my check.
Our next one comes from Hathaway in Arizona.
I remember one time I seen somebody walk off a job or quit. It was me. I was working in a warehouse. They had me doing some light work for like a month. It was easy. I was like, man, it's the best amount of money I'm earning, you know, ever. I'm not doing much. Next week, I came in. They were like, man, you got to load this 18-wheeler. I'm like, what? I walk over, the truck empty. It ain't nothing but dust and me in there. So it's just two dusty items. I just walked right out and said, man, I'm going to go pursue my rap career. And I quit that job. I'd rather be unemployed than load an 18-wheeler. I'm just being real with you. But have a good one, Momadi. God bless, Pete.
Yo, not mad at you about that, by the way. Like, that for real, manual labor? You know what I'm saying? Like, how has anybody called about quitting UPS?
Not this time.
No, they say if you could keep working at UPS for 3 weeks, you could be the manager because everybody's out of there after two.
All right, this last one, the guy didn't leave his name or where he's from either.
Man, so I worked at Target for like 2 weeks in high school. And, you know, it was cool at first. And then one day they hand me some 504 spray and a roll of napkins. And they're like, hey, man, I need you to clean every shelf in the store because we got, like, some big visitors coming. And I'm like, every shelf in the store? Like, this is a big box store. Like, I said, oh, okay, yeah, give me 1 sec. I'm going to go to the bathroom real quick. Went to the bathroom, called my mom. Like, hey, mom, I can't do this. I'm on my way back home. She's like, all right, come home. I'm going to cook some food for you. That was my last day working at Target, man. Never again.
Like, what is this, a fraternity? Like, the whole store, they was hazing him. How ain't nobody reported Target yet? How come we ain't got a bunch of stories about them like we do about Amazon? Damn. Yeah. Guys, y'all made the right decisions. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Caroline Anders of The Washington Post. Check out her story on the rising cost of bacon in California, thewashingtonpost.com. Thanks to Eduardo Castillo of the Associated Press. Check out his story about where the blame goes for the rise in crime in Mexico at AP.org. And thanks to Sam Sweeney of ABC. Check out his work on transportation and transit at abcnews.gov. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You can give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.